Good evening, everybody. This is Jeff J. Brown, China Rising Radio Sinoland, and I've got a friend who I've actually known for several years now, Colin Brace, on the show tonight. How are you doing, Colin?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Colin reached out to me several years ago. I don't remember exactly how or what, but and.
I ordered your books.
Oh, that's right. You ordered my books, and then, and I think you're still contributing, making a small donation each month. I don't know if that's still going on or not, but I really appreciate it. You're one of the longest. You're a legacy donator, so it all adds up. Really appreciate it. That's not why I have Colin on the show tonight. Colin is in Holland or the Netherlands. Colin, where are you in Holland? And tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm in the great city of Amsterdam.
Wow.
I've been here for 40 years. One of the things that fascinates me when I hear from you, I hear about you and you follow you, is how much you've moved about. So you've been in Brazil, if I recall correctly, and then you
Yeah,
were in
that's from
North
my
Africa.
yeah, I tried to live there and become a farmer there.
Yeah.
Work out.
And you've been very peripatetic, if that's the right word. So from one place to another, and now you've made another big move from Normandy to Taiwan. And I follow this and I think, wow, I've been living in the same place more or less within about 4 or 5 kilometers, radius of about 4 or 5 kilometers for 40 years. And I don't say it's better or worse. I've had a much different trajectory, to put it that way.
That's okay. Every horizon, every horizon created, we lose something. We lose something in the rearview mirror. But that's okay. Well, tell us about you. You've been there for 40 years. Where were you before that?
Well, I was born and grew up in the United States, like yourself. I'm an East Coast person. I was my family lived in Boston, on the
Okay.
in beautiful New England.
Yeah.
And my father was on the faculty of MIT, the big technical university there. So I grew up in Cambridge, in fact, just across the river from Boston. And in my early 20s, I met a Dutch woman, and we moved here together and lived together for some years. And then at a certain point, we went our own way, but I've been here ever since. And I got into the kind of the what you might call the language services business. I
Okay.
started working as a freelance editor and translator, and that kind of branched into other things. At a certain point, I started doing a mixture of journalism and kind of copywriting and pretty much anything to do with English, except teaching. I've never been an English teacher, but I've done lots of other pretty much everything else in the kind of the domain of the written word. And I did that for about 30 years, and I'm kind of winding it down now, sort of at the end of that particular phase of my life. And so I'm taking on other things like the Substack. We'll talk
Yeah,
perhaps a
we'll
little bit
talk
later
about
about.
that.
But one thing I will say though, having been here for 40 years is I may have missed out on some of the excitement of moving to a new country like you've done over and over again, but I have actually gotten to know the place pretty well.
I bet you have.
And it is, I have I can say now that I have a, have a kind of that kind of that take of an outsider who's been here a long time. So I feel like I do have some kind of understanding about, and you posed some interesting questions that we'll get to in a little while. And I hope to be able to answer some of them, or at least throw some ideas out there, which will be food for thought, if you know what I'm getting at.
Absolutely.
So yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
Did you get do you have Dutch citizenship? I mean, you
Yes,
must.
I do. Yes,
Okay, yeah.
yes. I
Okay.
did.
Good for you. Good for you. Well, listen, let's get started with some of my questions.
Yes.
I've read a lot about colonial history in Spain,
Yes.
Portugal, Britain, and France get deserved credit for their genocidal past. Yet Holland hides undercover about its colonial history. It even colonialized Taiwan. How can the Dutch get away from not being shamed too? How do they get away with it, Colin?
That's a good question. I've often wondered also about the lack of, how should I put it? It's not like a subject people here like to talk much about. I don't think it fits in. It doesn't fit in with the self-perception the Dutch have of being this sort of tolerant, liberal, progressive society. There is now, okay, there is now a little bit more attention to, for example, the role of slavery played in the 17th century and how it became was part of the important part of the economy, this kind of thing. But you're absolutely right that it's kind of slipped under the radar in a certain way. And I think one possible aspect of it is that it was never quite the same kind of expression of kind of cultural domination that the British projected this, this very much this exporting Britishness. So you have people still playing cricket in India and Pakistan, this kind of thing. Whereas I think that the Dutch colonial past was it's much more of a kind of a cold-blooded economic
Yeah,
arrangement.
mercantile, just merchant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
Haul out the loot.
so you don't go to, I've never been to Indonesia, but from what I understand, when you go to Indonesia, you're not overwhelmed with this sense of Dutchness. I mean,
Yeah.
they were there for what, 300 years, something like that, but they didn't really leave a very strong cultural implant the way also having never been to India or Pakistan, but I get the sense they have there. I mean, they still speak a lot of English in India, right?
Yeah,
Yeah, but I don't think
it's an official
there's
language.
only a few. Sorry?
It's an official language of India.
Yes, exactly.
English.
And I don't think Dutch is an official language of Indonesian. I only think a few of the older generation, the post-war generation may speak Dutch, but certainly none of the younger people. I think so. But that's only a partial explanation, I think. It's interesting because World War II ended here in May 45. That was like the moment when the kind of they that was the liberation day here is May 5th or May 6th, something like that. And so that's the kind of the end of World War II. And already in September of 1945, the Dutch launched a military operation to fight in Indonesia against the independence movement there. So they had barely shaken the dust off from World War II and sitting here in this kind of broken place. They were already heading over to Indonesia to make sure that their colony didn't free itself from the colonial yoke. And that's quite a, how should I put it? It's something of a contradiction, you might say. You might think that after World War II there would be this kind of like, well, we've had enough war for now. Let's cool it. Let's work on rebuilding this our societies, our cities, our decimated industry. But no, they headed over there to fight the War of Independence. It was quite a I don't know too much about the exact contours of that colonial war, but it was not a pretty thing. It was quite ambitious business. And I asked somebody once, a Dutch guy who'd actually been there, who'd been deployed to Java or somewhere as a soldier. I said, why did Holland go to war so quickly? Why did they launch themselves into this military adventure so soon after I mean, literally months after the end of World War II? And he said to me, well, he said, at the time, people felt it was sort of the only thing they had. The only thing we have left is our colony in Indonesia. And we didn't want to let it go. We had to keep a hold of it. And so they went over there and they fought obviously a losing battle, and eventually Indonesia declared its independence. And one thing to a letter, you may know about Sukarno and that whole Bandung movement. If they wanted to chart a course and neither be on one side of the Cold War or the other. They wanted an independent sort of third way. But that was not allowed. And eventually Sukarno was he was even if even though he was not quote unquote pro-Soviet, simply declaring your independence was not good enough. You had to be on our side. No sitting on the fence in that respect. No equivocating, or I don't think he was equivocating. I think he clearly wanted a charted independent path, much the way the same as the BRICS countries do now. It was kind of like a predecessor, a premonition of BRICS. But that was in the height of the Cold War. That was not to be. One thing or another. You may recall well that famous odious domino theory. That you know, if the U.S. didn't head to Vietnam to fight the war there, to beat the communists there, that the other countries of Southeast Asia would, and they were afraid of in Indonesia, of course. So, in any case, to get back to the original question, yeah, why doesn't Holland? It does. Yeah, it's somehow it's I think the country's kind of reshaped its self-image and the way it projects itself in the world, and it's kind of managed to kind of sweep that part of the history under the rug. And so the post-war image of Holland was as being this, tolerant, multicultural, multi-confessional society, which is progressive and all this kind of thing. And so they kind of buried the whole colonial past pretty quickly. But the funny thing is, right, you come to Amsterdam, where I live in the center, and you're surrounded by emblems and evidence. Even the prosperity of the city was built on this, the mercantilism you were referring to a moment ago. So the colonial past is, it may be people don't talk about it, but it's so evident everywhere. The great 17th century canal system was built up, or it was a very prosperous place at the time, and certainly the colonial relations played an important part of that. So why it's yeah so it's I hope I've I don't think I have a really comprehensive answer to your question, but I hope I've scratched at least a little bit at the surface there.
Well, one of the things I've actually read, I don't know if this is true or not, Colin, but I've read that people that if like a writer or a journalist or somebody who has a public presence in Holland starts talking about and divulging, what the Dutch did, because I mean a lot of people don't know they were in the Caribbean. They were all over the place. They were the Anglo-Dutch wars, and they were going at it, hand and fist, against Britain, fighting for territory. And but I have read that people who have tried to talk about it, they are ruthlessly suppressed by the government. And I've read that they're even threatened to lose their citizenship if they keep it up. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I've read.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how. That's quite possible, but I suspect that it's more of a kind of a collective will to kind of ignore it. It's more like we just simply ignore it and don't really talk about it. I mean, there is now, kind of like a kind of what I call like a kind of a woke dimension to addressing slavery, for example. They're planning a slavery museum here in Amsterdam. So there is some effort to, there's some interest in kind of reconstructing some of that. But so often it's cast in this kind of very much this kind of issue of kind of cultural identity and this kind of thing, without really, in my opinion, looking at the hard economic basis for it. You know, the fact that these colonies, these countries, were ruthlessly exploited for centuries, and the amount of wealth that flew into, you know, flowed into this country was immense. And I feel that it's kind of like a kind of an almost a dilettantish way to, I hope I'm not being disrespectful to people who care about, you know, the anti-slavery movement, but I feel it's a little bit dilettantish, and it's kind of, yeah, it's the kind of a superficial way of looking at the, it's framed purely as racism. And yeah, of course, racism did play a role, but it doesn't quite explain or investigate all of the dimensions of it. So it tends to be kind of a symbolic thing. So we'll put up a statue, we'll tear down the statues to our colonial, you know, oppressors, the admirals and this kind of thing. We'll put up a statue for this, and it's sort of a exchanging one collection of symbols for another. And yeah.
Well, another thing
So
that Holland is not, it does not get all of the celebrity, you know, all of the attention that France and
yeah.
Italy and England get. But it seems to me, and I do follow, you know, what's maybe more than most Americans, what's going on in Holland, because I actually, well, it's a long story, but I visited a lot of farms there back in the 1980s for a job I had, and I understand that Holland is kind of like a petri dish for the World Economic Forum and the World Health Organization and the Agenda 2030.
Yes.
It seems like they're trying to break Holland first so that they can then go after, you know, France and Italy, you know, which have bigger economies. So can you tell us about that? I mean, do you sense that that's going on?
Well, it's interesting. You know, you heard about the farmer protests a couple of years ago, and that just seemed, yeah, this is one of your questions as well. The WEF and then the farmer thing, and they're, I think that they're definitely connected, and it just seemed that the it just seems so irrational. This is a country, as you've observed, is has profoundly rooted in agriculture. It's an agricultural superpower as well. It's the largest, second largest exporter, agricultural exporter in the world after the U.S. Look on the map. I mean, it's a tiny little country, but it's very, very fertile and has a very highly developed, efficient agricultural sector. And you know, it's also very lucrative. I mean, they you know, the flowers and the vegetables and all the stuff that they produce them in the greenhouses throughout the year, especially in the winter months. You know, very, very big business. It's worth, you know, 100 million a year, 100 billion a year or something like that. And so why they launched this attack, it's another good word for it, on farming, and wanted to print, you know, just try to dismantle it. It's hard to put all the pieces together, but it seems to be a kind of a combination of this, you know, the kind of the globalist agenda of trying to centralize and break independence. So farmers are they're very, how shall I put it, they're independent. You know, they have a close tie to the ground and the surroundings and the environment and the, you know, the places they've lived and farmed sometimes for many generations, and so they still have a kind of independent spirit. And that's in this day and age, you know, with this globalist agenda trying to highly centralize all kinds of forms of control, this is kind of a threat. And so farmers have a way of being a little bit too independent. So there's this sense that we want to break the kind of the independent spirit of the farmer citizens and try to move towards a much more kind of centralized corporate form of agriculture. I don't think they're going to succeed. ultimately, because that's a that's there's too much resistance to that. There's too much, but can do a lot of damage in the process. And this is my sense about the World Economic Forum agenda, the heavily centralized, the globalist efforts to impose this very very authoritarian government in Brussels, is that it's they have all these ideas and these plans, but it's not going so well, I think, because it's very hard to impose this kind of top-down authoritarian control on people, unless you actually can deliver, unless you can actually, you can offer good governance. And we see it now, where we have these floundering from one government, one coalition to another, and there's a lot of unrest. And so, yeah, it's very damaging, but it's hard to see how they're ultimately going to succeed at it. The Holland is for sure very much at the center of the whole WEF, although it's been in the center of the EU, as you know. The earliest iteration of the EU was the Benelux coal and steel. That was back in the 50s. That was kind of a cart a kind of a basically it was a cartel for steel and coal and oil, and that turned into the, that evolved into the European Community, and then these it grew and grew and grew and became more and more centralized, powerful. And the Holland's been right at the center of it ever since. But as pro EU, as pro this and pro that, as the country may appear, it's never fully bought into it. I mean, let me give you an example. Back in 2005, I don't know, where were you living in 2005? Do you remember?
Golly,
Well,
no. So
it doesn't matter.
I was living in the United States.
All right. I was thinking, because you had been living in France, so I was wondering if you were
But then we went back.
plugged.
Then we went back to China, and then we went back to, and then we went back to France, and then we went back to anyway. But
Well,
yeah,
listen.
I was in the USA.
Well, maybe your wife might remember this, but in 2005, there were two referendums held in the EU, in two EU countries. One was held in France, one was held in the Netherlands, and these were the first two referendums designed to confirm the establishment of the EU Constitution. And this was a very, it was a, quite a long document. It was very, very, very much a, kind of a neoliberal template. It was very much defining the kind of economic model that the community would take. And we had these referendums in France, and we had them in the Netherlands. And both in France and in the Netherlands, a majority of the people voted against them. And so clearly, not everyone was on board at the time. Neither of these two countries has everyone been absolutely on board with all of this. So one can underestimate the public acceptance for this kind of the big globalist project. But one should not overestimate it either, because there's always been this kind of skepticism, shall I put it. And as you may also remember, around the same time, there was a third referendum held in Ireland. And that one was, for reasons I don't entirely understand, that was more of a binding referendum. So the Irish actually had, in that particular case, it had to pass. And the Irish also voted against it, which is the wrong outcome. So they were forced to actually rerun the referendum 6 months later. And somehow they cajoled, pressured, manipulated the Irish into voting the correct way this time. And after that, they abandoned this referendum system. And basically, the constitution was rebranded is the Lisbon Treaty.
Yeah.
And the Lisbon Treaty was deemed not didn't require what didn't they didn't believe that it required a referendum, so they just basically passed it in, I think it was 2009.
It's 2009,
And
exactly.
the Lisbon Treaty, that to me, I think, if you combine the Lisbon Treaty with the 2000, 2007, 2008 financial crisis, that was really like, I think, the turning point when an enormous amount of control was concentrated and brought into Brussels. And so it's been a long, gradual process ever since. But these are two of the absolutely, for me, key pivotal moments when, I mean, to me, the kind of the centralization force went into kind of overdrive at that point. And
Yeah.
it's been downhill ever since.
Yeah. Well, I'm a dual national. I have French nationality. I don't really follow politics in Europe, and it's awful. I mean, Ursula von der Leyen. She's an absolute totalitarian dictator. She's worse than any imagined dictator that you can think of. In modern history. And I think the first treaty was the Maastricht Treaty, right? Is it Maastricht in
Maastricht,
Holland?
yes. Yes, exactly. It's just the city in southern Holland, right near the Belgian border.
Yeah.
And that was in 1992. And
That was also
is
voted against, and then the legislatures overruled them. Is that no, they passed Maastricht, and then I think everybody figured out what a bad deal it was, and then the other two talking about they voted no. But then they just turned
That
around in
Maastricht,
France and just at midnight just overrode the popular vote and just passed it at midnight, in practical secrecy. So much for Western democracy.
Maastricht, in my sense of Maastricht Treaty was that it really paved the way for the euro. It kind of consolidated economic policy, economic control. Established this kind of proto central European central bank, and kind of laid the way for the introduction of the euro, which was in 2002. And that's been really a yeah that was a terrible decision. Terrible. I remember back in the late 90s, there was the Dutch Socialist Party. SP was it's never gotten very large, but it's always had a kind of a 5 to 10%, maybe a little bit higher, maybe a little bit around that kind of around the 10%, 5 to 10% share in parliamentary seats, and they waged a quite a persistent campaign against the euro, and I even have a sticker here somewhere, an old bumper sticker. I was cleaning up the other day and I found this "Say No to the Euro" sticker. And I don't remember all of the details of their campaign, but I think that it was the essentials. I think they got down that it was in trying to impose a single economic model on a collection of countries which had very different economic development paths. And it was kind of a one size fits all, kind of top down, push this thing on. And it's been good for some countries and terrible for others, as I'm sure you know. But
Well, we lived in France, lived in and actually had a business in France, a retail business in France from 1997 to 2001, and then we left and went back to the United States until 2010. Then we went back to China, and the propaganda for the euro and the total oppression of anybody questioning the euro. I mean, people were just brainwashed, they had to have the euro if they wanted to compete against the United States of America and all. And of course it's all the city of London, and who orchestrated the euro, because that's what they want. They want one single currency they can control instead of 25 different ones.
Yeah.
Well, what is it, it what what's the mood in what's the mood in Holland? Is there a possibility for a Holland exit from the EU, or is that will that ever happen, or is it just not on the table, or what's going on with all the anger with farmers and all that?
That's hard to, that's a complicated question, because I think that many people have a kind of an instinctual, you might call it sentimental, you might call it, somewhat self-unconscious belief in that European kind of unity is a good idea, that we should all, these are all tiny little countries like Holland, we have to kind of stick together, this kind of thing. And there's a certain, I think there's a certain rational understanding of that. I mean, let me put it this way, it's not a completely irrational thing. And I think that the European community of the 80s was, in many ways, a very good thing. It was basically, it's a free trade zone. That's the way it was started. It was called the EEC back in the day, the European Economic Community, and it was basically designed back then to kind of harmonize trade and to raise kind of establish kind of standards for exchange and consumer protection, all this kind of thing, and lots of good things came out of that, I'm sure. And so I think a lot of people, I get the sense, is they still haven't caught on to the idea that caught on that it's gone so much w further than that, that this once good system, good plan, a good idea has been transmogrified into something very, very scary and dangerous and highly destructive. And I think that people still haven't quite, many people at least, still haven't quite figured that out. So if you have a poll today or tomorrow asking people, should Holland leave, and should there be an exit, I don't think you'd probably find a majority. But if you ask them whether we should establish a European army, whether we should go to fight in Ukraine, whether if you get it deeper into the weeds of the politics, I don't think you'd find much enthusiasm for that. And I think there is a kind of growing, I don't call it Euroscepticism, okay? And we have a populist party now, the Partei, from the Freiheit, Party of the Freedom. It's the Geert Wilders party. They're very much a right-wing populist, to use the kind of conventional terminology. And they have a measure of Euroscepticism to them. And so I don't think people want their voters, their base, I don't think wants an immediate nexit, but they sort of want, like, keep Brussels at a bay. We have to make certain kind of decisions on our, we still have to keep a certain amount of sovereignty and some kinds of decisions. So it's kind of a it's not full-throated support, but not the, it's much the same way I think Greece was in 2015. They wanted a new kind of economic, instead of our economic policy, but they weren't quite ready to leave the Eurozone. They weren't quite ready to leave the whole Euro project. So, but it, my feeling is that the longer the EU continues along its current trajectory, the worse its decisions are. I mean, because we now have a completely unelectable, unaccountable, intransparent decision-making system in Brussels, and without any kind of feedback loop, these people are taking terrible decisions. Terrible. I mean, the whole Ukraine Bone the Lion marching off to Kiev every so often to kind of declare, do whatever it takes, all this kind of thing. These are terrible decisions. They're destroying, as you know, the German economy, and creating all kinds and but because there's no, it's not a really organic movement in any kind of way, any kind of organic, there's no kind of organic development of policy that it's going in the wrong direction. And I can't see this, I can't see this sustainable. There are people like Yanis Varoufakis who say, well, we don't want to throw the whole thing out. We don't want to destroy the EU. We have to reform it. But Jeff, how do you reform a set of institutions which are designed in their core to be anti-democratic? Not just undemocratic, but anti-democratic. I mean, these institutions,
Totalitarian
they
is a better
have
word.
contempt for popular will because they believe we can't trust the people. We can't trust them because they'll vote in the wrong types. Like they'll vote for a Marine Le Pen, or they'll vote for a Viktor Orban, or a Sahra Wagenknecht. So the whole system is designed kind of to basically smother popular, the really important stuff, little tiny things, about local domestic policy. Yeah, we have a little bit of room. We have some space here in each of our parliaments and in our, local municipalities. We can do things. But the big, really big theme, the really big themes, and I would say the big themes being economics and foreign policy. No, we don't have a say in that anymore. We're not allowed to have a say. And these things are being decided by people with zero accountability. This is not a system that can last forever. This is not sustainable.
Well, speaking of Ukraine, the former Prime Minister of Holland, Mark, if I pronounce his name wrong, Root or Rut,
Rutte.
Rutte. Okay, that
Mark Rutte.
there's the Dutch pronunciation, Rutte. He has
Rutte.
been he's just been nominated as the Secretary General of NATO. And he just took over from Jens Stoltenberg, a Norwegian. Is he going to be any better, or is he going to be a ventriloquist dummy for the U.S. Department of Defense?
Well, I think you've answered the question by asking it. Listen, I don't know that you've seen. He came out a couple of weeks ago, and I think it was his one of his first major statements. It wasn't. I think it was. I don't think it was the first time he appeared in public, but it was the first time he made a kind of a articulated a statement. It was on RT. I can send you the link if you like, because I found it extraordinary. He was saying that, we must ramp up our spending, and we have to defend our way of life, and we need to spend more on industry, and we have to accept the fact that we can have to spend less on social spending, and we have to encourage our banks and our pension funds to invest in arms manufacturers. And you can't believe you're reading this kind of thing, because I mean, just a few years ago, such this would have been fairy tale stuff. Nobody, we didn't think of these terms, but this whole Russia threat has been now so assiduously cultivated. And I'll be honest, he came across as basically the sales guy for the U.S. military industrial
There
complex.
you go.
Basically, they just want to sell Europeans more weapons and expensive weapons. These air defense systems, these J-35s, these high-end ticket things, which are extremely profitable for the companies to make. But it's a boondoggle, it's a scam. So he's to ask whether he'll be better or worse than Stoltenberg, based on his most recent comments on, it's just more of the same. It's more of this kind of bellicose rhetoric. Basically, it's I think what we're seeing is that the and this is a theory, okay, this is an idea. I can't necessarily prove this is the case, but my sense is that they want to use defense as a way of establishing further centralized control in the EU. It will be a way of, we need to spend more on defense, and it will be the kind of the nose of the camel under the tent for direct EU taxation. I think this is the Holy Grail in Brussels, because if you look at like the conventional nation state, like you look at France or England or the UK or the US, these central governments have large income streams in terms of taxation, right? And if you look at France, I believe that last time I checked, there was the French government was spent, French government spending was around 40% of GDP. So when you think about it, that's a lot. I mean, these governments are a big, huge part of the economy. I think if the US is a little lower, it's closer to 30. In Holland, it's around 35. I think in England, it's the same kind of ballpark. In China, I believe I looked it up a while back, and some, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's around 25% of GDP is state spending. And if you look at the EU, Brussels, it's like 2%. It's tiny. It's just a little. They have a. They get money from the country, the country national contribution. You know, we all pony up. Each country ponies up several 10 billion a year for the EU, and some countries are net contributors, like the Netherlands, and I believe England was, and Germany, and possibly a couple others, but probably France. And then you have like the net recipients. For example, Poland, I think, is the biggest, best example of net recipient. They get a lot of money for agriculture and this kind of thing. And so, but still, when you put everything back together, it's still tiny, 2% perhaps. And I think Brussels wants to push the federalization process further in order to they want a they want that big economic muscle, and they don't have that yet. I think that's like the Holy Grail of the Brussels bureaucracy, to try to get direct funding streams through direct taxation. And one way they could do that is by through the defense spending, by somehow bringing defense spending in, centralized defense spending into Brussels, and then saying, well, we in order to fund our defense spending, we need to have direct taxation. So that's something we have to be on the guard for. We have to keep a watch out for. And this could be, I mean, Mark Rutte and his people, the NATO, pro-NATO people, that could be their part of the strategy, is drumming up this Russian threat in order to force countries to spend more, and then to bring that whole kind of that whole gravy train into motion.
Wow,
So,
that's depressing. All that money going into one of the most corrupt cities in the world, Brussels. It's just a soup. What a corrupt shithole place NATO and the EU are. They're just fetid with corruption.
I
Anyway,
don't know
God help us.
if you've been following, how closely you've been following Pepe Escobar. He says that he thinks that the kind of the chain of command these days coming from the U.S. is via NATO. So basically, policy, top-down policy, comes from the Washington swamp through NATO into the EC to EU top. So that's his sense of the conduit. So in some sense, NATO is now, well, let's put it opposite, put it differently. EU is now kind of occupied by NATO. NATO is like the center of the spinning web, the web. And it's obviously a very complex relationship, and I don't think we should oversimplify it, but it does seem that kind of NATO policy, I mean, it seems to be have an enormous weight these days when we see that we see how Germany is being destroyed economically by
Yeah.
basically by NATO policy. And I wonder how many Germans realize what's happening there, or who the author is of their discontent. I think eventually the Nord Stream story will become a hot potato. They're still in kind of denial mode about that there, I get the sense.
Yeah.
But eventually that's going to come out. That's going to be, I think that's going to be a, it's still a public secret, but eventually I think it's going to be, the Germans will have to come to terms with that. They'll have to understand this was done to us by our erstwhile ally, and there have to be consequences for that.
Yeah. Well, let's
We
hope
may still
so.
be, I think we still may be some time off. It may be still, you know, who knows, a year, I don't know. But that's a mouse with a tail, as the Dutch say. It's got, you know, it's I don't think it's going away.
Yeah. Tell us about your Substack. I'm a subscriber, and you have written some fine essays. What was the inspiration, and what are your goals, and what do you like writing about?
Well, thank you. I thought I my inspiration was to try to make sense of what's going on here for people outside of their country. And because I think of all of the all of these European countries, they all have very much their own kind of character and their own trajectories. And I look for ways in which I look for issues where the kind of the Dutch trajectory reflects on the larger context. And so we're talking about, for example, this concentration in Brussels. At the same time, we're seeing like centrifugal powers pushing outwards. And each of these the centrifugal effort, the centrifugal energy and the centralization engine and centrifugal energy, they manifest themselves, I think, in different ways in each country. I mean, the way it's coming, it's manifesting itself as France is different than in Germany, this kind of thing. So I'm looking for kind of patterns, which the way it's happening here. And but I don't only do sort of geopolitics. I don't only write about geo. I also enjoy writing about some more kind of cultural and social
Yeah, you've done,
things.
yeah, you've done several about Dutch culture, and they were really good.
Yeah, you know, the bicycling culture and this kind of thing, and that type of thing. So, yeah, it's kind of a it's basically it's a kind of a personal project to try to make sense of what's going on around me here, and I think that the my sense is that the current trajectory, the current long-term EU direction, is going to fail eventually. It's going to, like, NATO and the EU are not sustainable. So I'm trying to, like, it's sort of like my personal mission is to kind of document it from my particular perch, my particular perspective. I think it will happen, but I don't think it's going to happen as quickly, and we certainly cannot we cannot forecast, we cannot predict how it will happen, or how it will look like, what the outcome will be. I think it'll the outcome will be, you know, will differ from country to country and this kind of thing. But it isn't sustainable, Jeff.
That's for sure.
And
Having lived there and voting there and working there and owning a business there, it's a nightmare. It's an absolute nightmare. It's the one factor that makes Europe better than the United States is we not everybody's running around with semi-automatic pistols in their cars. Loaded. We don't have that, but yeah, it's sad. It's sad to see. And just the awful leadership, Scholz and Rutte and Macron and Hollande and Sarkozy and all these bozos who are prime ministers in England. And it's embarrassing. It really is. It's embarrassing for the people.
What I find so perplexing is how quickly and how awful the political class has become. I mean, we had 20 years ago, we had German leaders 30 years ago, 40 years ago, who were sensible, smart, diplomatic people. Gerhard Schroeder and these people, I mean, whether you may have disagreed with one particular policy or other, but they were people of substance.
They were
And we
statesmen.
also,
They were statesmen.
exactly.
Statesmen.
And I think one of the biggest, one of the most perplexing things for me is to contemplate how quickly that all went downhill. And somehow there's been a very, very, a kind of a quiet coup, I think, in Europe, where any kind of independent minded, like Villepin, the former, I don't, you, he's given some interviews lately, which I've seen in subtitles. And Dominique Villepin, the former foreign minister of France, very smart guy, very, very well informed. And what happened? Why? Where did all those people end? Why did they disappear? Why have they gone from them? And I think that there's been a kind of a quiet coup here. And I think it would take another program to probably unpack all the reasons and the way that happened. But there has to be some explanation or a combination of explanations to help us understand why all of a sudden we're in this terrible predicament with all these terrible leaders and terrible ideas, and we're going in an absolutely wrong direction. It's tragic. Tragic.
What's on your to-do list in terms of geopolitics and writing and anything else along those? What would you like to share about your future plans?
Well, I don't have all kinds of concrete plans, but I would, yeah, I will continue to watch things here, and I take a, I kind of take the dialectical view of the way things are happening, and that you look for the kind of the overarching patterns and the counterweights. And when progress is being made, we see it, and when it's coming, when it's, we're falling backwards. So I don't have a very concrete answer for you. But the one thing I will say, though, is we are living in very interesting times. I feel that the past few years have been just one endless stream of profound crises, after one crisis after another, and it seems that we're at that this kind of epochal change. This the old, I see it as really the trajectory of the past 500 years. Western domination, superiority over the rest of the world is now crashing to an end. It's happening very quickly, very dramatically, and the rest of the world, I think, sees it and understands what's happening, but we don't understand it. Haven't figured out what's happening to us yet. I'm speaking now collectively, the West in general. I don't think we understand what the process is going on around us, and we're completely unprepared for it. And we still have this kind of innate cultural superiority about the superiority of our systems, of our cultures, of our governance, forms of governments, and these are collapsing around us, and we're completely unprepared for it.
Well, Colin, this has been a real pleasure. I will recommend your Substack on the interview
Thank you.
page, and
Thank you.
always enjoy what you write. And you obviously have a very fascinating story to tell about growing up in Boston and ending up in Amsterdam and loving it.
Well,
So.
thank you, Jeff. It's been a real pleasure for me to talk as well, and I always enjoy hearing about your stories there. And Taiwan must be a fascinating place.
Well,
So you've picked
come
a great
visit. Come visit. It's you don't
Oh.
even need a visa. You don't need to need a visa for 90 days in Taiwan. So it's an easy place to come visit, and we would love to meet you. And if I when I get back to when I get back to France next, I'd like to maybe try to come and say hello to you in Amsterdam. And actually, I've been I mean I have been in Limburg. I have been in Viborden, and I've been in all these agricultural areas in Holland, and I did not make it to Amsterdam. So I what is it? Is it anyways the in the town square they have the statue of a dairy cow. It's
Oh, okay.
it's in the Friesland. It's in the
Yeah.
Friesland area, and
Yeah.
so I know more about Holland for agriculturally than I do Amsterdam. So anyway, wonderful to have you on. I will give you a Buddhist bow and wish you the very best. And as soon as I get this out, maybe you can cross post it on Substack when I've last it on Substack. All right.
Sure, love to. Thank you.
Stay
It's
in
been a
touch.
pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.